Hello everyone, this is Raghav. Before we get started with today's episode, we wanted to ask a super quick favor. In order to better understand and to serve our community, we are asking our listeners to fill out a super quick, anonymous, 5-minute survey. The link to that survey is bit.ly/SMOA survey. That's bit.ly/SMOA survey. We're really hoping this information can help us to do what we're already doing better. That's it. Thank you guys so much, and on to the show.
Welcome to Social Medicine On Air, a podcast where we explore the vibrant world of social medicine. We learn through conversations with healthcare practitioners, researchers, and activists who are working to create a more just and healthy world. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Social Medicine On Air. We are very pleased today to be with Anna Mullany, who's joining us. My name is Brendan Johnson. I am a medical student at the University of Minnesota and a theology, medicine, and culture student at Duke Divinity School.
How's it going? I'm also here with Mr. Brendan. My name is Raghav. I'm a medical student at the University of Vermont. Happy to be here.
Wonderful. Well, Anna, could you maybe jump in by telling us a little bit about yourself and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me. And I live in southern Vermont in Brattleboro, and I'm a fourth year doctoral student at University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I'm in the public health department. I'm in specifically the community health track, which I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about today, because that has a particular political bent to it. And I also am a teacher, so I teach within my doctoral studies. I'm also teaching within the public health department to undergrads. I teach a couple different courses. I've taught a writing class. I've taught an introduction to public health, and I've also taught a public health and imperialism class, which understands the health impacts of U.S. imperialism. So I've been doing that. I also teach within a teaching program called Spark. It's a separate from UMass. It's a Vermont-based program, and it licenses K-12 teachers. And so I do some teacher training for that too.
I'd love to talk a little bit about some of your own research work. It sounds like you were talking a little bit about it before we just started. Maybe you could give us a really quick summary of some of what you're doing, and then we could jump back with a question about it. It sounded awesome.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So I have worked before I went back to school for my doctoral work in public health. I had worked for probably over 6 years full time at a local crisis center. So I have a background in working around the issue of intimate partner violence and, what I've been more actually calling patriarchal violence, gender violence. So I worked at this center and definitely saw the wreckage that does to people's lives and how it interrupts their lives. So it kind of was a natural fit to keep studying this as I'm doing my doctoral work, because I have this set of skills and information and knowledge about it that I could really expand. So my research work is around looking at a particularly rural intimate partner violence, which most of the research done is really on urban centers. But there are particular characteristics of rural areas that actually make the violence, it can have more psychological and physical damage to survivors, even though the rates are pretty much the same between urban and rural. But there are differences. And the other...
Can you expand a little bit on some of the differences between rural and urban domestic violence and what you saw in your clinic, if you're willing and able to speak about that?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So the biggest difference that people talk about that are in this field is the geographical isolation of rural intimate partner violence. And that actually then trickles out to a couple things. And so with rural areas, there's often a lack of public transportation. There's often, for instance, here at the crisis center I am associated with, some of the places where we cover are a good like hour and 15 away. So for someone who needs our services and needs to get to us, and there's a lack of public transportation, that is a big issue. Oftentimes people can be living in a situation and their closest neighbor is like 3 miles away. Mm-hmm. So there's that component. There's also a lack of rural hospitals. And that's a big, like actually increasing problem of like the underfunding and mm-hmm. rural hospitals closing. And so that's a big piece of it is the isolation. The other piece of it, and this is something I've seen so much mm-hmm. in my work, is that these communities are often kind of characterized as close-knit communities. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge lack of anonymity within these areas. I can tell you on a very regular basis that I can walk out of my house and see someone that I've maybe worked with or see someone that I know. Like I know all the people in town who, mm-hmm. I should say this. Mm-hmm. Like I know, for instance, certain information about businesses or people who work at businesses that have been abusive to their partners. Mm-hmm. And I mean, so that's on my side of things. On the other side of things is that actually also increases the underreporting in these areas. The worry that, you know, they don't want to say something because the whole town knows who this person is. And that's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's clear that like there is in these small communities, it is hard to report sometimes because of like the huge stigma and shame that is across like any area of intimate partner violence. But I think that it can be more intense in these areas for sure. So those are kind of like the two main things.
Sounds awful and so unbelievably terrifying.
Yeah.
To be isolated in that way and feel so helpless. And it sounds like you were sort of counseling and connecting.
Yeah,
and
I was doing a lot of...
I was going to say, does it seem like there's some... What do you feel like characterizes the moment when somebody who's undergoing that violence and abuse, what do you think makes it possible for them to reach out for help? Right? Because these are things that go on chronically for a long time and right. And then there's a moment when this individual suddenly feels, something needs to happen. I need to do something about this. I need to notice that this is happening. What is that moment of, I don't want to say empowerment. I don't know if that sounds patronizing, but that moment when they feel able to have the capacity to reach out for help and name the problem and get out. And I don't know, am I even talking about this?
Yeah, I was gonna say it's like quite complex. So
yeah,
an intimate partner violence is a very complex issue that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding around. And so to answer your question, it's like there's a number of different answers. Like for instance, a lot of people, even though this particular crisis center has been here for, I think, going on 47 years, there's people that still don't know we exist. Mm-hmm. And so then they find out, and then that's when they call us like, oh, mm-hmm. there's a place that I can call that, you know, is completely confidential. Another thing is that a lot of people don't recognize that they're in an abusive relationship, especially when it's heavily psychological abuse, mm-hmm. because that just one does so much damage psychologically. And also, as you know, like a lot of these toxic situations are so normalized within our society. I think sometimes people reach out when a friend has really urged them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is to like, okay, I've reached that point. I'm going to reach out. I think it's also important to say that across the board, people who reach out to crisis services are also struggling with other situations. We're more likely to hear from low income or no income women. We work with all survivors of violence, I should say, but we, as you can imagine, mostly are working with women who are experiencing violence from a male partner. But you know, that doesn't say, like, of course, violence, like, crosses class and all sorts of, I mean, you see it in all sorts of pockets of society, but that's also, those are the people that we're often working with. Yeah, go ahead, Brendan, were you going to ask something?
Well, this brings up a question for me, too. I mean, it seems, as I'm imagining this, like, very important work that you're doing, and obviously, on one level, you're doing it in kind of, like, the micro, as it were, like with this one center and with one town or one area. And then also at the same time, like you have this very interesting perspective by studying it epidemiologically and even connecting that to questions of like capitalism and political economy, which feels like very abstract, I'm sure, when you're actually in the room with somebody. What is it like to have both of those perspectives in your head, or how does that help you serve these folks better? And Or maybe your experience, like, how does your actual experience doing the work then inform some of your questions about political economy?
Yeah, that's a good question. Like, I've learned so much actually just doing the work. Here's one thing I'll say that I've said repeat, because I often, I'm still associated with them and I still sometimes train new advocates. Mm-hmm. One of the things I always say to them is that I've never experienced like quote unquote burnout. People often ask me if I do, like, oh, it must be so hard listening to these stories. Like, I don't know how you do it, that sort of thing. The reason I don't experience that is because of the way I think about health and because of the way I understand how like larger formations impact our lives. So I don't think that we're going to solve violence against women by just looking at patriarchy. Therefore, what I do on the daily at the crisis center is managing, you know, and people are having a hard time and I'm like equipped with the skills of like active listening and being able to like help them with resources. Mm-hmm. But I don't, and of course, like the work can make me sad. Like I've heard countless stories of like horrific violence, especially against women. But my political analysis actually, I think, keeps me in it. And the one thing I was going to add too around that is that part of my research is also looking at crisis centers. And this is like the political economic piece of it, is that Patricia Morgan, she wrote this article back in the 80s that I believe it's called... it's something like the state's management of social problems, but most importantly, what she talks about is what she calls the social problem apparatus. And I am looking at how, so the battered women's movement was like a piece of the larger women's lib movement that came out of like the 60s, 70s, 80s. And what Patricia Morgan writes about the social problem apparatus is how these struggles started to rely on state assistance in order to get like really necessary services. And so the battered women's movement is like quintessential of this. And there was a lot of like different theoretical lenses on intimate partner violence and violence against women. And so there was people that were saying like, it's patriarchy and it's like misogyny and we need to really like dismantle patriarchy. And there are other, what is like known as like the more left part of that. And this includes Angela Davis. This includes the Kampahai River Collective that has was left black feminist, socialist feminist that said, it's not only patriarchy. It's that we also need to look at the US like capitalist state and imperialism and how capitalism actually necessitates putting men and women in like a different social standing for the reproduction and for profit accumulation. And so if we are only like have a lens on patriarchy, it's not really understanding the problem in full. I bring that in because what happened with the, and back to sort of the social problem apparatus, is that Patricia Morgan was saying that some of these grassroots movements didn't have a thorough like analysis of the state and the capitalist state. And so, and that's like a gap. And so what happened with the battered women's movement is that not only were they had to rely on some state funding for their services, they also, at the same time, it was the rise of the U.S. carceral state. And so also their solutions to male violence was discipline. And so they really like agitated the state to say, we need more legislation and we need to see this as a crime. What we know, of course, is that carceral solutions, like even if you don't have an analysis of like the violent incarceration system of the U.S., carceral solutions routinely fail women and their children. And we know that like they don't really work anyway. But the crisis centers in what we have today are a product of that movement. And they kind of were stripped of some of their radical roots. And it took, when she talks about this social problem apparatus, it takes out the political, it takes out the economic, and it says violence against women is a social issue, period. And we need services for survivors. And it loses that more like nuanced analysis that is really needed for actually emancipation for everyone, you know, not just people who are experienced violence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's super helpful. That's super helpful. And like, even it makes me reflect on the way that kind of the imagination, going back to the question of imagination, like the way that the imagination of these organizations were shaped by kind of acquiescing to state support and acquiescing to like, okay, well, if this is where dollars and resources and grants are going to come from, like one kind of ends up pruning one's own branches, as it were, of like the analysis that in order to kind of like fit into the system as it is.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's also what you say with the imagination. And so part of my research is also saying, do we need to reimagine crisis centers? So it's not only looking at this piece around rural intimate partner violence, but it's combining it with looking at these structures that are serving these people. Also, I just want to like mention, I just, cause it's so important to say, is that like, also the state is so violent toward women,
right? Right.
From like slavery to eugenics, to incarceration that is gobbling up more and more women, to police brutality, like especially toward women of color. So it's like, yeah, I mean, it's Angela Davis who has said, you know, how do we rely on the state, that the state itself is violent?
I think it's a recurring theme on this podcast and probably in a lot of our inquiries that this stuff is all pretty tied up, right? Racism is very tied to climate change, is very tied to patriarchy, is very tied to capitalism. And we somehow need to be building, again, yeah, we need to be building these more fundamental top bottom changes that are deep and long lasting, and yet there's people who are doing that work. And again, there are alternatives, right? And this is something that Dr. Waitzkin talked about too in an episode. Again, the mindset of there is no alternative,
right,
is sort of a mindset that we're taught and put into it. And it could never be any different. It has to be this way, but it doesn't. And there are people who are doing it differently, and that's why I think it's important that we teach people that, right? We don't just teach people about Indigenous people in the lens of like object and like garner, you know, like receiver of care or receiver of violence, but as agents who have deeply important, powerful, radical visions and histories and who've lost access to their land. And we need to really rethink what we're teaching and how we're teaching. And I want to go back to something you were just saying about sort of reimagining the crisis center as also as sort of being a part of this more interdisciplinary, structural agent of change. How would you do that? What would you change about the role of the crisis center? What would it be doing in your sort of imagination to address these sort of interconnected issues that we're talking about at the intersection of racism and legislation and incarceration. And,
Yeah.
Maybe that's too big a question.
No, it's a, I mean, it's a really important question. It's a great question. The problem I see is that we are focused on single issues. So the crisis center is operated solely around services for women that are experiencing intimate partner violence, providing a safe house for those that really need, like, are fleeing and really need a confidential location. And then, you know, doing legal advocacy and all this kind of stuff. And I think that we need to, one, I guess, expand our understanding of violence and who gets these services. Mm. For instance, like, oftentimes, I mean, this is such a, there's so many contradictions. Like, this is one of them. We don't, crisis centers don't house people who are experiencing violence. Or, sorry, let me say that again. Crisis centers don't house people that are experiencing homelessness.
Hmm.
However, we know that a woman who is homeless is more vulnerable to violence. There's, like, right. such a contradiction there. And so I think that, like, my main kind of drive is that we need to expand the lens around intimate partner violence that goes beyond a patriarchal lens. That that we need to also see how people are experiencing violence because of, say, losing their home to eviction due to, like, COVID, and, like, and making those links, right? I think that my issue is not necessarily even so much with just, say, the crisis center, but it's with social services, that it's like we each have, like, a siloed issue, right? But where are we seeing actually the links toward that? And by having just, like, this place works on homelessness, this place works on domestic violence, this place works on LGBTQ issues, where are, like, actually our struggles connected? And how do we, right. like, even re-envision how people get their needs met? I mean, I think that your question is such a big question, because we have to really see how, like, one, I mean, Audre Lorde is the person who said this, is, like, there's no single issue struggle, because people don't live mm-hmm. single issue lives. Yeah. At the same time, I really think, like, we do have one enemy, and that enemy is capital, and it's how that really wrecks and, like, destroys people's lives. But there's so much, like, division that is institutionalized within us, just as social services are institutionalized. But I, you know, we have a long way to go. I also believe that the reality is that a woman fleeing violence absolutely needs, like, a safe home. Like, she needs the crisis centers are essential right now because of some of the help that they do give.
Yeah, another, you know, one thing I was thinking about too with your idea of the silos and whatnot, it comes back to me to the difference between, like, top-down structures of giving and whatever power structures that are top-down versus structures that are more horizontal. I feel like that idea of seeing the interconnectedness of issues of suffering, of hurt in your community requires you to be local and horizontal. And, you know, we all have so much power, right? Like, the individual person has a lot of power, but we sort of, like, give our power, right, in service to in service to the state, in service to capital, as opposed to sort of sharing our power with each other and using that sort of local space to make change. And again, it's just coming back to all the people who I feel like are doing this kind of the right way. And I think, you know, the Zapatista movement, I feel like is an example where they've done a lot of work around like centralized, like trying to really intentionally fight patriarchal mindset and, and patriarchal forms of government and empowering and centralizing the wisdom of women and women in the community. And I feel like part of that like happening requires like a localness, a horizontality, you know, like you can't, if you're sitting far away and it's just easy to be like, okay, we're going to, you know, build 75 crisis centers and 75 jails and 75 health centers. Right. But it's very hard to live in a community that's, oh, like our poverty is deeply linked to our not having a supermarket, is deeply linked to, you know, the way that our, I don't know, our neighborhood is built or whatever it is. And, I'm just sort of waxing, not in any particular direction, but
No, that makes sense. And I think it's also, I always want to make sure I say this because it is so important, is, and I've learned this, I've been like really influenced by Angela Davis of the, her, a lot of her writings from the 70s and 80s is she really talked about how it's not as if like having this analysis of really periodizing patriarchy, like understanding it in its capitalist form, doesn't mean that we don't, it's like we have to do them both. We have to fight against like toxic masculinity. We have to fight against, you know, boys bullying each other and calling each other faggots or whatever. Like we have to, you know, fight for the rights of trans women. And like all that is so important. And that's like the daily kind of like, yeah, like just how I said, like there are women especially that need like a really safe place to be because their partner has threatened to kill them. And so it's like we have to hold that, but also like have the analysis bigger because we're it's like missing a huge gap if we just say this is all we concentrate on.
I think that you're one of the folks who has probably thought most deeply about what education looks like and like how to teach social medicine well. And I'd love to hear more about how that experience has been. Have there been light bulb moments for your students? What are the educational approaches that you take? You know, connecting some history of the last 100 to 200 years with present day challenges and phenomena. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, sure. I actually got that question yesterday from one of the teachers in training in this Spark program. And what I thought about is how, I mean, considering your podcast is called Social Medicine, that the way I would define that is also really linked with how I think about public health and then, of course, my teaching. And so social medicine and public health to me is really examining the conditions and structures within our lives that give rise to disproportionate disease and suffering. And so I think the important thing too is when we're talking about conditions, it's not just social conditions, it's looking at historical factors and then political and economic conditions. So one of the, I think, things in public health that is, and I'm guessing you two have heard of this, is there's a huge focus on social determinants of health. And it becomes like a sort of a laundry list of let's look at housing conditions or employment or poverty, income, and then also like biases into that too. So let's look at racism and sexism and how this impacts health. And there is a huge focus on that. But the criticism I've read about that and then the criticism I have myself is that social determinants often is just examining those, documenting them, and then talking about how they impact health, but not questioning why that is happening and why for instance, like we talk about poverty as a social determinant of health. But why is poverty happening? And also, how is poverty both created and maintained and reproduced within this political economic system of capitalism? And so when this, the question you asked me and the question that I got yesterday from this student teacher was, how do you bring that into the classroom? And I stressed that, yeah, it has to be not just like social determinants of health. It's got to bring in these other components.
And it sort of seems like, I feel like that gets to the difference between social determinants of health and structural determinants of health. Do you feel like the term structural determinants of health is more useful, effective? And then, yeah, curious, like, how is the teaching of these sort of underlying phenomena, how are you sort of actualizing that in the classroom? And how can we go about teaching those things in a way where it doesn't all just become sort of a litany and a laundry list? What does it mean to really engage with those things in a participatory, personal, reflective manner?
Actually, I'm glad you brought up structural determinants of health, because that was something I wrote down, and that one of my huge influences has been Dr. Vicente Navarro, who's at Johns Hopkins. He also works, he has a center in Barcelona, but he's in his 80s. He's worked for years in public health. He's a political scientist. And he calls this the structural determinants of health. And he really, I actually wrote down this quote by him that I think is really useful to our discussion, in which he says that he thinks about health, the way that he defines health, is a social and political category imposed on people within an enormously repressive and economic capitalist system. And so I think that that's useful in thinking about how disease and suffering often is imposed on people. And it can't be delinked from thinking about how capitalism functions. So the way that the teaching question that you asked is, what I do with students is I start with giving them some history, especially because what we're talking about and what Navarro talks about is nothing new. This is not some sort of like new revelation we've just had. It goes all the way back to Engels and his working class, the conditions of the working class in England. And that was way back in 1845. He was talking about these things is when he wrote that. And I also look at Virchow, who's he wrote this report from the report on the typhus epidemic in 1848. So this is an example of how I get students to think about this, is I start them with that. And I know you also had Howard Waitzkin on the show. I listened to that show. He talks about the social origins of illness. And he also like talks about these two. And so I have them do a reading by Howard Waitzkin on these two. But I have students, you know, students who've never thought about public health, and they come thinking that it's very behavioral type issues to look at. They think of it very much in terms of like biological manifestations of disease. And so many of my students this last semester loved the Engels piece because he talks about how British capitalism forced people to live in debilitating conditions that really affected their health in awful ways. And so, you know, he talks about the rise in alcoholism. He talks about the toxic chemicals used in the factory and the increases in lung disease. He talks about posture, the way people have to stand at these machines. And it led to a great conversation in class about drinking. And I try and relate that to the college campus and thinking about drinking and why we, and stress and all that, those kind of issues that are linked with that, which is what Engels is talking about. And then Virchow, like he of course is known, like best known for his, cellular pathology, work. But he also, which I think is less known, is that he really argued that scientists and doctors, I think he called them like the natural attorneys for the poor. It's something like that. But he talked about how doctors must link their work to political action. So, I mean, I would love to hear you two as doctors, how you think about that too. But he looked at the typhus epidemic in Upper Silesia, and he saw that these people were poor, and like, how was poverty created, and how were these people, or how and why were they really suffering from disease? So that's like a place where I will start with my students. And I think like the other thing, or an example of what I've done with them is that I had them look at type 2 diabetes in the Pima and the Otohono Indians in southern Arizona. And I mean, I build on this, right? So I have them do some of this background work of like understanding social origins, understanding that like historical context is really important. And instead of just talking about the health of these native populations that I'm sure, as you know, like experience incredibly high rates of diabetes. And this is something also new, like a century ago, they did not. So that begs the question of why, what happened, is that I also get students to think about their own learning on Indigenous populations. So what did they learn? Like, what have we all been taught about why Indigenous populations are poor? Why do they experience higher rates of certain diseases? And I have them watch this movie called Bad Sugar, in which it explores these issues. It's a 2008 documentary about the southern Arizona Indigenous populations. And what I did this past semester, because we were on Zoom, is I had them have whole discussions outside of class with like four or five. And in those questions, I said I wanted them to discuss how the information that they learned contradicts what they learned about Indigenous populations growing up, and also how it connects to our learning on Engels and Virchow, and thinking about it's really hard to, and this is why I pressed all semester, it is actually quite hard to teach that capitalism is not only an economic system, it's a social system, it's a political system.
Right.
And this is quite hard to teach. It's not easy because it's not what we're taught. We're taught that it like is like hanging over here somewhere. And so it's hard to teach, but it's what I find is like the students love like the things that they're learning. Cause they're like, I mean, I've had so many students say to me, wow, I had no idea that's what public health was. I had a couple of students say to me, I mean, these are first year students that are like, yeah, I'm going to like major in public health now. I'm like, sweet. So I would love to play. I know I told you this, I had brought up a clip of my students speaking.
Yes,
please. It's very, very short, but the first one talks about how what she learned, in this Bad Sugar film really contradicted what she learned as a young person. And then the second one is, I have a student connecting his learning to the Virchow reading. So I'm just going to play this. Brianna, I'm actually going to direct this to you first. You had said that there were high levels of erasure. Could you talk about what you meant by that and just some of your learning?
What I mainly meant by high levels of erasure is we basically didn't learn anything about their culture, their language, meaning their language, what they wore, how they interacted with each other, their religion or religious beliefs, what community meant to them, family structure, basically anything that makes a culture we didn't learn outside of Thanksgiving and outside of the context of colonization. And even the conversation around that made it sound like they needed to be colonized to become more advanced and to be fit to join greater society. And which is basically implying that they were inherently inferior. I think that's what I got out of my education.
It reminds me of the example of the typhus epidemic we talked about.
Yeah.
And how money like circulates from the poor to the rich again. A good example of the people at the bottom are losing still, which they don't have much to lose.
Explain that a little bit. You said the money circulates from the poor to the wealthy.
Yeah.
Tell me, explain that more in relation to the Virchow, Upper Silesia, and the typhus. Where is that coming from in your head? I want to see what you're
doing. I think it was because the farmers were working their entire lives, basically, and it was just to make crops that the people at the top would like sell and benefit more from than the farmers themselves. And in this example, it's not necessarily money, but also the water and the land that they were taken, that was taken from them, and they were left with nothing, basically. It doesn't just have to be money, but it's just things are being taken from the poor, and it's easy to do that.
Oh my God, my students are like, I love my students so much. I'm so proud of them. I had to bring them into the interview. I also, as you know, I have a radio show here, Indigo Radio, with a bunch of educators. And I really try and pull my students when I can into the shows. And so that was a clip from actually a whole show I did with them on Indigenous health. And we did it right on Indigenous People's Day. So, you know, that's a way that I've pulled them in. And it's just amazing to see. I mean, I've had a great mentor in my life that talks about how you have to kind of like hook them in. And I find every semester when I teach is that when you're teaching them things that makes them question the very society around them, they're hooked. They want to know why. And there's so much in health to do around that. Yeah, I would love to also tell you about the community health stuff I've done with them if you want to hear about that. Because I think it's really important as a teacher is that we also are showing stories of what could be and what people have done. And because again, going back to my criticism of the social determinants of health kind of discourse now in public health is that it's not also teaching people how to act and how to act on what they see that is not okay. Right. And so what I've done is I've used the Cuban health doctors, the community health doctors, to show them what is Cuba doing and how do they do it so differently. And then I've also used, and this is what I really wanted to talk about, is that I've used the Young Lords and Black Panthers and looked at both of those groups and how they had health programs and did a lot of not only programming, but activism. So one of the, and this is what I wanted to talk to you about community health education, is that the Young Lords, so in 1969 and 1970, they took over the Lincoln Hospital in the South Bronx. And they were seeing like how their community was not taken care of and how like poverty was just laying wreckage to people's lives. There was a lot of heroin addiction. There were a lot of like unsanitary housing conditions. So they took over this hospital. And one of the things that they say is that they talk about how they treated people who were struggling with heroin. And they say, this is a quote from them, methadone was not only the medicine used, the other was political education. And I think that like is the essence of community health education, that it's not just, it's a combination of health and treating like individual health linked with political education. And I actually wanted to read you all this quote because it's from the same article around the Young Lords that I have my students look at. And they say that each patient received a copy of, and this is in quotes, "The Opium Trail, Heroin and Imperialism," a pamphlet written by the Committee of Concerned Asian Scholars that advocates political revolution
as, quote, an alternative explanation and another focus for anger, as well as collective support and some sense of direction. And the pamphlet urges, quote, the movement can be the best form of therapy. And so I bring that kind of teaching into the classroom so that students can really see, like, what have people tried to do? How can we push back against this and also politicize our lives? And I'll tell you this because one of you had asked me earlier, you know, what are some of the students' thoughts? Is that no joke, every single time I teach about the Black Panthers and their health programs and or the Young Lords, I have students say to me, why did I never learn about this? Yeah, like I have never heard of them. Why would we not learn about this?
That's incredible. That's incredible. And I love the way that you are able to expand the imaginations or like offer these different historical examples to the students as a way to say, what are the possible interventions, you know, that are much larger than just kind of this behaviorist model that, and actually, you know, one of the articles that you sent us ahead of time talks about this idea of social theory. And so that's kind of where my mind is going with this. But social theory in terms of what determines health, you know, what are the ways that we conceptualize the ways that people are well or ill? And is that only just based on the individual's behaviors or the individual's like ability to stop smoking or to eat well or something like this? But if that's the only thing that we ever talk about, that totally negates our imagination in terms of political change or community organizations or, you know, any of the other things that we'd want to be interested in doing. So that just like strikes me as a really interesting way of expanding kind of the social theoretical imagination of the students. And just by even just talking about these excellent historical examples, mm-hmm. of the way that people have agitated for their health of themselves and their communities.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I know I had wanted to ask you too, also of as people in the medical field and thinking about how Virchow talks about this, doctors should be linking their work to political work, mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. how do you both think about that? Or are there ways in which you like do that or want to do that?
Raghav, you go first. You're much more in the medical space right now than I am.
Yeah, you've been kind of out of the clinical world for a little bit longer. So I'm a fourth year med student. And I feel like my perspective on this is a couple of things. One idea that I've been really trying to centralize is trying to resist the almost this like hunger on behalf of medicine and doctors to think that they can solve every problem, you know, like, oh, we can solve social illness and we can solve poverty. And not that they're even really trying to do that or care that much in terms of a systemic thing, but as physicians, when those of us who get excited about it, we try to immediately position ourselves as like the ones to catalyze that change, the ones to lead that change and foment that change, I feel like sometimes. And so I'm in that space and as soon to be a physician and whatnot, and even as a med student, like I really want to think a lot about activating, partnering and decolonizing, you know, and like using the power that is inherent in being a physician, wielding outrageous amounts of money, sitting at the gateway between, you know, our gigantic wealthy healthcare system and society, figuring out how to be an agent in that space to move resources and challenge, and then to get new people into the space and to activate other people to be the leaders, and activate other kinds of voices and to decolonize the structures that make us think that there needs to be a leader as opposed to some sort of horizontal framework, sort of like a community-based perspective. You know, those are some of the things that I feel like I'm personally trying to think a lot about. And I think it speaks a little bit to some of what you were saying with the Young Lords and the Black Panthers and, again, trying to be more horizontal and community-based. And, you know, and this is probably totally unrelated, but I was reading something recently that talked about how, like, when there's a leader or, like, when you have a leader, it's also very easy to govern. It's also very easy to turn that leader into another tool of the state or another tool of the political authority. And how we like need to try to move toward, again, horizontal structures and partnership structures. And that was kind of rambly, but yeah, doctors don't, we don't need to be the ones doing all the stuff. And I think we need to move away from that and move towards partnership and activation of others.
Yeah, that's, I really appreciate that, Raghav. And at least speaking for myself, you know, I've been currently in this master's program for the last 2 years, so I'm a little bit out of medicine, but I will be returning this upcoming summer. But for me, the way that I've focused on this has really been trying to, I think similar to Raghav, what you mentioned about like expanding our imaginations about the ways that we are pursuing health. Like it doesn't always have to be led by, you know, the physician and like the kind of capitalist model that we have where we commodify health and are just trained to be cogs in the machine. But, you know, my interest has been kind of in through this podcast and then through my graduate school right now, looking into historical examples, looking into examples from different communities, looking into examples, even the history of Western medicine, like Virchow and some of these figures, like what are the expanded horizons of the ways that people have pursued health. And like, we really need to be drawing on those because this, the challenges are so great right now. And so that's kind of my interest, at least at present, although I really think it will change when I'm more back in the clinical space, but like helping to create a space for people to be talking about kind of a more expanded imagination and kind of like going back to the roots in a lot of ways, even if you, there's many, many examples in history and that could be a whole other conversation, but I feel strongly that pull to explore kind of the different nooks and crannies that are really neglected in a traditional medical school education. But I really think that that's where life and healing is going to come from for some of the challenges that we're facing. Health challenges, political challenges with inequality, economic challenges, environmental challenges. Like we really need to be saying that this is one fight. This is one project that we're all in side by side, arms linked together to Raghav's point.
Yeah, totally. Yep. I agree with that. We're actually showing, have you seen, sorry, tangent, but the Dirty War, the John Pilger movie that came out in 2019, that it's about the privatization of the NHS in Britain, but it also, like the first hour is kind of focused on that, but they modeled it after the US system. It's free online. I bet you both would be into watching that.
Sweet, thank you. The Dirty War.
It's called The Dirty War, and it's John Pilger, who's that Australian journalist.
Wow. Yeah, that reminds me as well. One of the events that we had in my program, there was a Latin American liberation theologian and bioethicist whose name is Alexander Martins, and he was speaking about his experience growing up very poor in the Amazon in Brazil. And being involved as he was growing up in the establishment of, well, he was trained as a nurse and then got involved in the public health world as well. And like being involved in the creation of the national Brazilian public health system and the kind of human rights-based approach, it was in the constitution and everything. And evidently in the last year or two, there's been a series of neoliberal changes with the government there. And they've just opened the doors to American health insurance companies, which are now entering the market where there previously was no market. There was no space in the market because everything was a single payer system essentially. And he was very kind of distraught and worried about that. But I think it sounds like a very similar example of the way that, you know, an existing company in a capitalist framework needs to grow, you know, 7% every year, 7% every year. And that means that it has to break into new markets, such as the Brazilian health market or the NHS, even though that's like very bad for human health. And we know that the American experience with that, I think, shows that in comparison to other countries.
Yeah. And it dictates our relationships with each other. I'm thinking like as you two as doctors or myself as a teacher, like within there's these institutions that we work within, and the privatization of health then totally influences what you can do as a doctor. And so you're up against a lot, like pushing against that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's, as you both have said, it's really important to look outside of the field of medicine, the field of health, to find examples of how to, yeah, push the imagination, envision the alternative, build the alternative, advocate for the alternative. And yeah, I mean, it's just, this wasn't all inevitable, you know, and I think that's what you're getting at with this, again, social right. versus structural determinants of health is inequity, poverty, racism. These are created. These mm-hmm. were all a function of some choice somewhere along the way. And they're alternative modes of being and living where mm-hmm. this wouldn't have been that end conclusion. This was a choice, you know, made over time and that we continue to choose, you know, we continue to choose this because it's easy, it's facile. And so, yeah, we have to start getting a bit uncomfortable and break out of all these things that make our daily, day-to-day life so comfortable, but also fill us with so much angst and unhappiness. And we're on this capitalist treadmill. It's really sad and very frustrating, I think.
Yeah.
And I, even as I'm just reflecting on this now and in the rest of this conversation, I just want to say thank you to you for all the wisdom that you've shared. And especially, I think, something that I found really provocative was, you know, in all of your work, like you're bringing these larger questions of patriarchy, of capitalism, of our relationship with the state, with like the state's violence, all these things, history, but you're bringing them in not as like a way to run away from the very real issues that mm-hmm. you're going to face, like with the people in front of you on that local level, on that horizontal level, but actually that larger vision is something that funds your work in a sense. And it, like you were saying, it prevents burnout. It gives you inspiration. It gives mm-hmm. you a community of like-minded people who you're able to find. And I find that really interesting. And like to not see those kind of two poles in tension, but actually rather as reinforcing each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this wonderful interview. We've just really enjoyed having you on and learning about some challenging but very important topics and the way that you're able to do work in a number of wonderful different places.
Yeah. Thank you so much. This has been great. And it's, I mean, part of Indigo Radio, and I'm sure for your podcast too, is that it's so awesome to meet other people.
Yes, yes, yes.
Doing work and trying to like both articulate this stuff and like figure it out together. Yeah, yeah. It's really great. And I think that's part of what Indigo Radio tries to do. It's part of what the Spark Teacher program tries to do is like, we need to like keep connecting with people and like, and building this, right?
This is Social Medicine on Air, co-hosted and produced by our team. Jonas Adelis, Sebastian Fonseca, Raghav Goyal, Brendan Johnson, Layla Sabah, and Poetry Thomas. Intro, outro, and incidental music credits go to Smith the Mister. Huge thanks to Dr. Marwa Salah for feedback and advice, and to Clara Brand for designing our logo. If you haven't already, please, please leave us a review and give us some stars wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us to keep going. And if you would like to share your story on the podcast or have any thoughts, questions, feedback at all, please reach out to us by email at socialmedicineonair@gmail.com or on Twitter at @socmedonair. We would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening.